Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Jason Gianni, who's an author, educator, session drummer, Broadway drummer, and most importantly, he was the drummer on the intro for SpongeBob SquarePants. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. It's so good to be here, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've met at PASIC. I think in 2019 we briefly met, but this year in 2021... we actually got to talk. I think you, me, and Mike Dawson and a few other people were kind of standing around and just instant kind of connection there, which was great. And I saw you spoke with the drum set committee about kind of remote learning, which is very topical in 2021. And you did a great job. So really, really happy to have you here.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. And that panel was really good this year. It was a really apt subject matter.
Yeah.
You know, and man, we could have talked for 2 hours more on that. You know, I wish it didn't end so soon, but it was a great panel.
Yeah, it flew by. It's the era we live in where if you're a teacher, you gotta pivot. And people can't see this right now because we're doing a video, but it probably won't get shared. But you have an awesome setup with, you know, you might do some playing today. You've got, you know, beautiful drum set with mics and everything. So you're set up and ready to go for online lessons, which that's very important.
Yeah. I really had to do quite a bit over the pandemic because I was doing some online lessons before and I didn't have a problem with it, but I didn't really enjoy it that much.
Sure.
But one thing the pandemic did was finding out that I could use first what was my EAD from Yamaha, mm-hmm. and then eventually flipping it over to my interface, and then getting a little webcam set up and everything. It just became an enjoyable experience, and it saved a lot of money in my pocket commuting in and out of New York City every single day.
Yeah.
So it's actually something going forward from here I'm going to do quite a bit more, which is great.
That's great. And once you're set up, just never update anything as far as software goes, because once you're good and you're flowing and everything works, then just don't mess with it.
Oh, you don't have to tell me that. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So today's topic is going to be, we're talking about music of the 40s and 50s and really the evolution of the backbeat. And we have some, these are always fun. We have some really cool audio examples that you have selected. I don't know. You want to kind of set this up a little bit before we jump in and explain the topic, and then we will hop in with our first example and break it down?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, let me say a little bit of background on myself in general. Sure. With this is that for a very, very long period of time, I, like many people, I grew up with certain types of music when I was a kid. And when I turned 18 and went to college, I started studying more different, you know, genres and that sort of thing. And by the time I was 19, I was really heavily involved in more and more jazz, of course, and fusion and Weckl's stuff and that kind of thing. And then I went to the Drummers Collective for a summer, and which, by the way, I've been teaching there now for, this is my 16th year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. And what ended up happening is that my MO as a drummer at that point really changed. It became all about versatility and really getting to the root of a lot of different genres, a lot of different feels, a lot of different styles, a lot of different drummers. And I started to find out that I really liked this style as much as I liked that style that I grew up with. And not only was that a sort of a good thing for survival as far as being a professional musician, but that I really enjoyed listening to Miles Smiles as much as I listened to Michelle Camilo, as much as I listened to Hemispheres by Rush or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So that really became important to me, that versatility became like really big subject to how I was going to now go through my career. It wasn't about 10 years ago that I started to kind of think to myself, well, wait a minute, I've been doing all this versatility and these different types of gigs for years, but I never really dug into the history of why are we doing this rhythm? Why is a Cascara rhythm important to us? Where did it come from?
Yeah.
One day I was sitting down with a great historian and my good friend Daniel Glass, and we started talking about the idea of just the backbeat and where this happened and how did that come about? And it, all of a sudden, it just kind of, this light bulb went off in my head of like, well, why do we sit down on the drums and now go do, 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 do?
Yes, good question.
Where did that language come from?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And one thing that occurred to me is that there was a major cultural change around the 40s into the 50s of if you sat down with someone in 19, well, let's say if you were a drummer in 1945, What's the first thing you probably were taught at that point?
I would say some rudiments or some, you know, marching type stuff. I mean, it just doesn't seem like you'd be doing backbeat drumming at that point.
No, probably nothing like that.
Yeah.
Probably all the things you said, like a rudimental style, or just ding, jinga, ding, jinga, ding.
Yes. Sure.
And that was more of a big band thing where the hi-hat was constantly on 2 and 4 and the ride cymbal was constantly ding, ding, ding. Didn't get to the point yet with the jazz, you know, more sort of, you know, bop or contemporary stuff where things started to move around, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. But then what happens in the late 40s into the early 50s is somehow, well, especially into the 60s, drummers now were going as their first listening point. Where did that change over? How did that happen? You know?
Yeah.
And one thing I'll say as sort of a little left turn, I think it's important to note that from people that understand history, there were so many problematic social issues going on in our country back then. But there was so much evidence destroyed from paperwork standpoint, things that were kept in the churches that were destroyed. And of course, we didn't have technology then like we do now. So there was a lot of stuff not recorded. So when you think about the person or the idea or the actual moment that something happened, it's hard to really trace and say, this is the person that did it, or this is the first time it happened.
No, it would almost be the first recorded time it happened.
Right.
Or you know what I mean? Where maybe someone's always done something first where maybe someone heard it and then it spread, especially in that day and age. But yeah, that's a good kind of caveat to all this.
Yeah, like I'm a huge fan of Bernard Purdy, and he's a friend of mine, and you know I use the Purdy shuffle all the time. But is he the first guy that ever put a ghost note into a shuffle? Probably not.
That's a good point. Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I'll always give him credit for that groove, and you know we'll never take away that name. But you know it's really hard to really just say, okay, this is the first time. You know.
Yeah.
So we use this sort of like range of time, and these examples of, you know, when we could talk about these type of subjects. And one of the things I've noticed about music, when we were talking a little bit before this started, was we mentioned, okay, the drummers that change thing. I actually think more it's about the music that changed things. And that, like, the idea of, like, the feel of the music and that change in culture was actually more from the music or the composers than the drummers themselves.
Yeah.
And I have some examples to prove from that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great way to lead into it. So why don't we kick things off here? I have our first track, As Strange Things Happening Every Day by Sister Rosetta Tharpe, 1944. And you describe it kind of as stylistic history of rock and roll. Anything you want to say before we hear this track?
Yeah. So I only actually discovered Sister Rosetta Tharpe about, again, like 10 years ago. And I still haven't listened to a lot of her library, but I've listened to enough of it where she is so ahead of her time, and they call her the godmother of rock and roll. And for those who have not heard her, she's obviously a gospel, blues, southern, composer, but an amazing guitar player.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen her, she was like so far ahead of her time with that too.
Yeah.
There's a great video sample of her playing live at like a train station of all places on YouTube. You could see it, and she's so kicking ass, man. It's like amazing how great she was musically. You know, it's this is where those lines start to cross where you go, okay, yeah, it's blues and it's gospel, but there's this like lilt to the music, and there's this, you know, attitude to the music that if you just throw like a bopping piano on top and maybe play it a little faster, it's Little Richard.
Yeah,
man.
Exactly.
And it was like 10 to maybe 12 years before all that, you know? So you could play it and then we could talk about it a little bit after.
Yes. Here we go with the first song, Strange Things Happening Every Day.
All we hear church, people say they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day. On that last great judgment day, when they drive them all away, there are strange things happening every day. Every day.
Yeah, man. I mean, it makes your head bob. I defy you to listen to that and not just kind of like, it seems more, and just the lyrics and the format of the song is very, I don't want to say pop, but I just mean, it's designed to make you move and feel something.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what's one of the things I pick up on when I hear that is like, there's more of a shuffle feel present than just a walking feel from the bass.
Yeah.
Da-doom, da-doom, you know what I mean? Da-doom, 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 da-doom. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yep.
And you hear like a brush pattern behind it.
Yep.
And I always talk to my students when I talk about history. I stand in one place and I immediately hop to another place and say, we didn't go from here to there in like one shot. You know, like, you know, yeah, that took like 10, 15, 20 years to get us to like what we do today.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's like little hints of like, yeah, there's a little bit of like a tiny bit of a backbeat there, a tiny bit of like a strength on 2 and 4 rather than all 4 dum 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 ba dum ba like a walking line.
That da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum. Yeah, and with most of these recordings, especially from 1944, it's a little hard to differentiate every single instrument, especially with the drums. So kind of keep that in mind. But I'm sure it was brushes, and it's if you listen closely, you can hear it all. But it gets clearer and clearer as we go down the list in time. But man, she's a powerhouse.
Amazing.
Her look. There's just some famous pictures of her. You don't expect her to be holding the guitar and just owning it like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, she was like literally the first rock star.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
So one thing I'll talk about before we get to the next example is that for what I know, because I've heard this in a couple different situations, is that so in the early 40s, probably the biggest venue in the South and the radio show was the Grand Ole Opry and the Ryman Theater down in Nashville.
Yep.
Okay. And so much music was coming through there. And this is like one of the first places that you can really go to and see like regular touring acts and that sort of thing. And, you know, in the South, obviously, you're talking about not just jazz at this time, but like the blues and the gospel and you know, all these different types of acts coming through there. And from what I know, the drums were banned for a certain amount of time. Did you hear that?
Well, there's an episode way back, The History of Country Drumming with Matty Meyer, which it's been a while, but like, yes, it was banned. There was no drums. Then I got to remember this, but then I think it went to a drummer could be on the side of the stage off, you know, not in the view. Then I think it was like a snare drum could be on there. Then it was like, I forget who it was first, but it was this, which it, now we're just like, why? Who cares? Just bring the drums on stage. But yes, it was banned at first.
Do you know the reason why it was banned?
I'm sure he said it and I forget at this point, but why was it?
Well, it was too loud, simply.
Okay. Sure.
Now, do you know the reason why it was brought back?
Because amplification became...
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only just amplification, which was really important, but the development of the electric guitar and electric instruments.
Sure.
I don't remember the very specific day, of course, as we talked about before, but it was somewhere around like 45, 46 or something where they really started to like promote this electric, you know, guitar was plugged in, amplification, that kind of thing. And I don't know specifically if it was a live thing or remember Grand Ole Opry was a radio program. And there was a variety of radio, variety programs and radio programs at that point. So maybe it was something like over the air where they're just like, they can help drums now to sort of boost the sound. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think there was an element of like, okay, music is getting a little in those days, the definition heavier at the time, you know what I mean? And we can sort of bring them back in again. So it's really interesting how, I always feel like the role of the drums, and this could, we could take a left turn here for a second. The drumming and rhythm has sort of pushed music in the direction that we know it for many, many, many years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe people don't even, it's like subliminal too, where you don't really think about the importance of the drummer, or maybe, you know, the average music listener doesn't realize how important that rhythm and that backbeat is. But it's like you take away the drums from something, then how does it feel? It's not the same. It is not the same at all. Even bass players, which maybe, you know, you think to yourself, oh, that, you know, what is the bass adding? It's like, it adds a lot. You know, anything away and it's not nearly as impactful. But yeah, I think you're right. Drummers really did push things forward.
Well, like, we could even go further back, and I don't want to make this the whole topic of conversation, but obviously everything with rhythm, with hand drums and languages for so many years, and,
yeah,
you know, how that was brought over to the southern part of the United States, where the slavery movement, slaves were talking to each other, mm-hmm, from field to field on the drums. If you go to classical music, Beethoven started with timpani, and Mozart and Haydn with just 1-5-1-1-5-1, and then you get to Beethoven's sixth symphony, which is called the Pastoral Symphony, and timpani starts doing thunder and representing a storm. And by Mahler, they were using like 12 timpani, and it was like melodies and all that kind of stuff, you know. So drums had this huge impact on like where music went to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was this sort of symbiotic relationship between what the music was doing in general, the dum ba dum ba dum, and then how the drums fit into that and bringing them back on stage, like we were talking about. It's a really interesting topic we could talk about for like hours, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and it's, I don't know, there's something that's just like, you can't even put it into words, the importance of like you said it originally. And sometimes I think to myself, like, you know, it's like existential, like a drummer going boop, bop, boop, bop with a band. It's like, what is that? Why is that so important? Why, what? But then again, like I said, you take it away, and then you realize, oh, that's why it's there. But it's just this perfect meshing of these instruments with this backbeat, and it's the most important thing. In the without it, it's, you're not moving, you're not feeling. So I think that kind of just inherent, it's in us, that love of that rhythm and that percussion. So there's no escaping it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one thing I always talk about with Afro-Cuban music is like everything meshes together like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And it was created on the streets of Havana, not in some sort of conservatory.
Yeah.
And, you know, here I am, you know, promoting, you know, all the teaching that I do and going to school. And I'm like, man, half the crap that we've done is like done on the streets and internal and stuff. You know, it's amazing. That's really
so
amazing.
Funny.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big weird circle. Yeah. The next song would be The Fat Man by Fats Domino. And I put this in, it wasn't anything like much different than what we heard with Sister Rosetta Tharpe, but it was sort of a good bridge to Rock Around the Clock, which comes after that. But you could play a little bit of The Fat Man by Fats Domino.
Yeah, and this is 1949. So we're half a decade. We're kind of jumping ahead 5 years.
Right.
So yeah, let's have a listen. Here we go. Yeah, that, man, so the first one kind of had me bumping head, like, forward. This one has you kind of doing a side-to-side swing, you know? I just, you can't deny your body the way you move. I've always found that in studio work, too, where it's like, you could change a mix a little bit, and then you see people start moving a different way, and that is, like, natural. That's, like, follow your body, you know?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I put that one in because for a couple of reasons. Number one, Fats Domino was a New Orleans musician. And I often find like he's a little bit forgotten about in regards to the beginnings of rock and roll and the soul thing and the blues thing. And how, like, if you listen to that piano. All right. So now Sister Rosetta Tharpe was the guitar.
Yep.
Now it's piano. And to me, again, it's like, that's, again, Little Richard. You know, I mean, make it faster.
Yep.
And make him a little more exciting, and it's Little Richard, you know, and Fats was like huge in that respect. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but you really don't hear any drums there, but that's a song, you don't even need any drums, you're already moving.
Yeah, it's I don't know, some of these early songs, you get that thump off the bass, which would obviously probably be an upright bass at that point. And you get, there's almost like a hiss to the recording where you're almost like, is that a hiss or is that a cymbal or is that a brush?
Yeah, right.
And so I don't know. But like you're saying too, where you get, you're putting these ingredients together to almost, then you're going to get to Little Richard, but it's like, you need these ingredients. Little Richard couldn't have pulled these ideas out of nowhere. He had to have the inspiration, and it's just it's neat how it all works.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the next song, and I love this whole idea here, is Rock Around the Clock. Now everybody knows Rock Around the Clock. Okay, 1952. Actually, Bill Haley did the most popular version of Rock Around the Clock, and I was talking to you last night over email where I have a version where it's not even the one that everybody knows.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I don't even know where this version came from. What is this? You know?
Yeah, man, that's so common with a lot of these. Is like, we think of these songs as like, this is the famous one, but it's like, you never know who actually wrote it or who, where it actually came from. I mean, you can figure it out pretty easily, but it's kind of who got biggest first, and that's who gets credited with the song usually.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many writers, especially coming from Broadway, there's so many writers like that did things for like, composed things for shows and composed things for other artists and all that kind of stuff. And you're right. It's like, they all take a shot at like making the best version of what's written, you know what I mean? Now, here's the cool thing about Rock Around the Clock and Bill Haley in general. So Sister Rosetta Tharpe was a guitarist, you know, gospel blues, you know, player, all right?
Yep.
Ray Charge, who we'll talk about in a minute, is also came straight from the gospel world, okay? Fats was more of just sort of a New Orleans musician. Bill Haley was a country musician. He wasn't a rock musician. He wasn't a gospel musician. He was a country musician, okay? And a lot of people go, well, Rock Around the Clock is really probably the first rock and roll song. Okay, you can arguably say that because it's so early and the way that Bill Haley did it and the elements in the music, yes, but he's not a rock musician.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting how a lot of this stuff sort of all collapsed on society from so many different, you know, parts of the world, parts of the, you know, the people, the black community, the white community, the different type of musical communities.
Sure.
We, again, like I was saying before, we didn't just start here and jump over to here and we ended up here. It's a conglomeration of a lot of things. Now, one of the things about the rhythm of this song is that, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the term, but there was a term that guitarists used to do at the time where they used to put a dollar bill in their guitar. And when they would do that in between their strings, they would get this thuk, 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 yeah, thuk type of sound.
Yeah.
And they'd still able to form chords, but it would be like a rhythm with a harmonic motion as well.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and then Bill Haley's bass player was playing upright, but slapping. So you have that kind of, you know, that whole kind of thing. And that was totally creating this open door for the drums to come through and duplicate what was going on. Now, we still didn't quite have the dunka, dunka, that kind of thing, but we have, you know, like sort of like a displaced sort of thing that the drums were doing. And then there is one artist I want to talk about after this that I don't have the list. We'll talk about that in a second. But why don't you play that and you'll hear all those rhythms in there.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on, join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock, gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4.
Man, that bass and the drums are just like, it's the sound, you know, that slap. That's so cool.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
Yeah, like all that, like that thing that's going on is like, it's again, I said it before, it's like an open door for if I was going to hear that for the first time, and I never really heard the idea of like slamming a backbeat down, I still probably wouldn't want to just go ding, ding, ga-ding, ding.
No.
Like, I'd be like, I got to do something more.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Know? Yeah. And there's a toughness to this song, which maybe you can't not have the social, you know, what's happening at the time. Because as I'm playing that back, it's like a video off YouTube and it's a bunch of it's pictures from American Graffiti. And it's like, you know, people out cruising in their hot rods and stuff, which might be a little bit like movie-ish to have right. Harrison Ford and all this stuff. But like it's so culturally important at that time. But, you know, it's neat. It just puts you right back in that, you know, what I think of from movies is the 50s. It's the song, of the, one of the songs of the decade, you know?
So one of the things, this is a really, really important point I got to bring up that we probably should have talked about a little earlier, but something that was happening a couple of years before that started to kind of really open the idea of the drums, you know, creating the sound. If you go back to the 40s and the 30s with the big band thing, obviously the start of the low boy mm-hmm. and then the hi-hat created the idea of the hi-hat being on 2 and 4 and, for lack of a better term, the first kind of like ostinato
sure.
that drums would use of this just cha-da-doon, 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 you know, that sort of thing. And what ended up happening is, as you know, especially the low boy, but the hi-hat is such an insignificant sound. Well, significant at the time, but now like a lost sound. Like you don't hear it because mm-hmm. everything's so loud and, yeah. and that sort of thing, right? So what ended up happening in a big band, especially a big band, as the bands got bigger and louder, as the hi-hats started to get lost. So before we got to the drums actually playing what we know as the, like the 2 and 4, yeah. guys like Lewis Jordan, saxophonist, Lionel Hampton, a lot of band leaders started using hand claps as replacement for the hi-hat or duplicating the hi-hat.
Sure.
And you could see some old videos of the whole big band putting their instruments down and clapping their hands.
Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what that ended up happening is that was sort of like the sort of the language of, okay, this is where music is going. And in the jazz world, so now we're not talking about blues or the country or the you know, the backbeat world kind of thing. In the jazz world, that led to rockabilly. And that's kind of what you just heard with Bill Haley is totally. That before it's like real rock and roll, it was almost like this country musician doing a rockabilly type of thing. And so the replacement of the hand claps now started to get into the rhythm section. And then the drums took over. So that's kind of like that progression for the most part.
The timekeeping element where it would maybe be early on where you're on the snare drum with it and then maybe the hi-hat would come in and you're keeping time on the hi-hat and then the clapping and stuff. That's you can follow that progression of, and also too, like you said, where it needs to be louder. It needs to cut. If you have a tiny little hi-hat, you know, that is two small cymbals put together that isn't even really a hi-hat early on, it doesn't cut. But there's Lionel Hampton is a great example, obviously, as a percussionist. People are realizing the importance of this, of that rhythm to make people move, I think.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And hence, now at that point, the language is really changing. You know, people are starting to hear this. Drummers are wanting to play this. You know, again, you just go 10 years before and ching, ching, ga-ding was your main, you know, language at the time for music. And now all of a sudden it's changing a little bit, you know. So now the next song I have on my list in 52 is Hound Dog. But this is Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Eventually, Elvis obviously made it popular. But why don't you go ahead and play that?
Sure, here we go.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crocking all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crocking all the time. Well, you ain't never gonna ever, and you ain't no friend of mine. When I said you was high class, well, that was just a lie. You know, I said you was high class, well, that was just a lie.
Nice. Yeah. It really, like, I mean, that's drums. You know what yeah. I mean? That's like using the instrument. And I'm sure other songs had too, but that's using the instrument as a real element of the song, not just a backbeat kind of like, you know, keep things moving. Like that snare, that fill right there at the end.
The fills. Just, yeah.
It's, yeah. It's more real and modern.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And the, in comparison to the other examples we played, that really, you can hear that 2 and 4 there
yep.
now. it's popped in.
Yeah.
And again, it's like one of those things. Well, is that the first song that ever did it? No, probably not. But with the elements we're talking about, it certainly is one of the first.
Yeah.
With the now the ding ding ding, the kind of shuffly thing.
Yeah.
Mixed with the heaviness of the music, mixed with the fills.
Yeah. The vocal. You know, now, the vocal cuts. The
vocals cutting. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And this, by the way, was 3 years before Elvis made it popular.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, and by the way, I'm sure you do the same thing. It's like you start going down the rabbit hole of opening up topics and you go, okay, I found something. And then the next day you're like, oh, no, but this came before.
Yeah.
Oh, no, but this, you know, and you're like, crap, man, where's the origin to everything? You know, so it's really interesting how, like, as you keep going back, you keep finding more and more things like that.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, and the different versions. I know Big Mama Thornton did a version of it. Which I guess it almost, I'm just throwing that out there so people know, because there's like who wrote it, who was first, all this stuff. But again, in history, people think of Elvis. It's
right.
Which this version that we just heard, if I didn't know,
yeah, it's like,
and you
closest
just
to Elvis,
played
yeah,
that to
yeah.
me, I'd go, oh, that's Elvis. Yeah. That's a demo yeah. of Elvis. It sounds that kind of gritty vocal, that very similar, that style.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know why it was given to Elvis. I don't know, you know, if there was a certain specific reason or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could have been obviously the whole Elvis, the pelvis, the sexiness, the bad boy kind of thing,
yeah.
you know, and that was a bad boy type of song.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously sex started to make its way into music at that time. That's another thing is like, you know, pre-1950s, there wasn't a whole lot with sex in music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a song in the late 30s called Let Me Rock and Roll You by the Something Sisters. I'm totally drawing a blank right now. But it's like it's supposedly one of the first times that like rock and roll was used in the title of a song.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and you know, people started to kind of speculate what that meant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And even Alan Freed, when he got on the radio, started going like, hey, rock and roll, man, you know, and people were like, well, what does that really mean? And then it was like the whole, well, is this this connection to like a van rocking and rolling and having sex in that van, you know, that kind of thing, you know, and music
funny.
Just got more bad, you yeah. know what I mean?
Yeah, so, exactly. Because people, I mean, again, you think of like American Graffiti, which I think everyone knows, but it's obviously a great movie, George Lucas and other, you know, a lot of stars in it, but it's like that we're now going to be, this is our music. It's kind of like people start to get their independence. There's like sexual revolutions and all that stuff. So the music, yeah, of course, music, what came first? The kids wanting to do it or did the music push things forward? Who you can't really tell, but that's absolutely, sexuality is for sure a part of it.
Well, it was certainly a combination of a lot of things landing together. And here's a real big thing that I talk about rock and roll. I think is a major, immense thing, is that I read an article a couple years ago about the fact that in the beginning of World War II, there was something like 43,000 TVs throughout Europe or something like created, right?
Yeah.
And with the whole Industrial Revolution and all the jobs created throughout this time in World War II, by the end of World War II, it was like 1 million. So it kind of went up this big slope, right? And then by the end of World War II, up to like the early 50s, it got up to like somewhere it went from like 1 million to 10 million to like 50 million.
Wow.
Or 60 million. And then worldwide, you know, there was this massive climb. So media became a huge thing with the success of like, you know, the teens getting into like the new forms of music.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Elvis coming out and shaking, you know, Elvis was like the first person to like, you see the hips shake on TV.
Yeah.
There's a really funny episode of The Honeymooners. I don't know if you watch The Honeymooners.
Not as much as I should.
Oh my God. It's one of my favorite shows. But you probably seen like Ralph dresses up. It's a famous, scene from Back to the Future where Ralph is in this weird costume and he's dressed like a pinball machine, and then Alice comes out and she's dressed as a little teeny bopper girl, and Audrey Meadows had gorgeous legs, and she had this really high skirt on, and he goes, where's the rest of that? And she goes, that's part of my costume. He goes, your knees are showing, you know, and in 1954, like no woman looked like they yeah. didn't show that on TV.
Yeah. No, absolutely you know what I mean? Not. I mean, they'd be like, that's like back when they're measuring the length of your like bathing suit to make sure it's long enough. And, you know, you were mentioning TVs and I thought of Back to the Future too, where they're like, first off, they were like, oh, it's a rerun. And they're like, what's a rerun? And then they say, oh, we've got two TVs. And he's like, he's joking, honey. No one has two TVs.
Yeah. 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 It's a major thing. Like everyone had just one. And, you know, like in the 40s, you know, the families would crowd around the radio during Grand Ole Opry or something like that and listen in. Right. And then when the TVs came out, it was like this massive, massive revolution. And then you combine it with the teenagers and the badness of the music and the Elvis shaking his hips. And it just changed everything.
Yeah. And you can see who you're emulating. You can.
Oh, for sure.
You can visually see, oh, I'm going to slick my hair back now. I'm going to start gyrating my hips uncontrollably. all this. So. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. All right, well, let's move on here.
The next song on the list was I Got a Woman by Ray Charles. And it actually, you know what? Play it because there's one thing I want to talk about that. Go ahead and play that one, 1954.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind of friend indeed.
Man, boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom.
Right?
Awesome.
Yeah, now you got that double backbeat kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is like when you think of shuffles, you know, like a the Lido shuffle or something like, you know, by Carl.
Sure.
Picaro. You know, that ducka, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep.
It's like that was probably the root of that idea, you know. And when you hear James Brown talk about the idea of like, you know, the double backbeat or like things shifting around or funky drummer or going da-da, you know, that kind of thing. He listened to Ray Charles. And a lot of times Ray Charles this song is actually known as the beginning of funk.
Interesting.
Believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. A lot of funk players look back to I Got a Woman and go, hey, that's where things started to really change with the versatility of the backbeat now, not just going goon crack, but like a goon gaka goon gaka goon gaka, you know, that sort of thing. Really cool history there.
Yeah, and you know, I wonder if the player who I should know the drummer on that, but if they realize the importance of what they're doing at the time is a conscious choice, or if it's like, you know, sometimes when you sit down at the drums and you play, you can't even really. You're not even deciding what to play. It's just coming out of you. You know what I mean? Like, it just happens. I would imagine that cultural, historical impact isn't really in your mind when you're recording that song with Ray Charles. It just felt right and happened, and it just so happened to change, you know, music.
Well, I'll play you something real quick, and I'll tell you a funny story about this.
Yeah.
So, do you know what this is? You know what that's called?
I know that pattern.
Yeah, it's called the fat back beat.
Okay.
Okay, and then if you listen to this.
Yeah, you got some
that's
James
called
Brown.
Sweat by James Brown,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so here's the coolest story about this. So, and it sort of answers your question, is that apparently, and again, it's like, who did this first? But when you were down in the South and you were playing in the clubs down there, the drums were often set up right near the kitchen. And down in the South, one of the things that was the popular thing to do was to, fry the pig in the oil. Okay.
Yeah.
So what they would do is they would throw the back of the pig or the, you know, the all the meat of the back of the pig into the oil, and it would create this plop, 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 this popping sound. Right.
Yeah.
And somebody said to the drummer, create a groove that would reflect what you're hearing in the kitchen.
That's awesome.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow. That's so cool. I mean, but we've all had that where you hear like, you know, a drip in the kitchen or something, and you go, that's a rhythm right there. Yeah, that's like, like you're trying to follow it. That's so cool.
Yeah. So that idea of like the displaced groove,
yeah,
you know, or the changing of the backbeat was now the roots of funk and dance, you know, the 60s, early 60s dance.
Yeah,
which was funk, you know, or that soul, that kind of thing. You know what I
mean?
Yeah,
I feel like if you displace the second, you know, the four or whatever a little bit, it makes the one hit harder. You know what I mean? Like once you get back on, I feel like that's the whole thing, is to just like tie it all back together like that.
Well, remember everything in music. Remember what drumming or music was in general, even back like thousands of years. It accompanied dance.
Yeah.
Sure. That was the whole point of it, right? So even rhythms like, like the seven, you know, the Greek sevens and elevens and things like that. That was all like hip movement, or when you break up a rhythm, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 3, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 3. The idea of having a bigger grouping was so the man could spin or dip the woman in a dance.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So like the idea of all that moving around shaped not only music, but shaped the rhythms and the feel of music as well.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So like based on what you were saying before, you know, I wonder if like culturally we were thinking of this kind of stuff. I don't know if there was a like, I'm going to school theory type of thought of it, but I think there was definitely some sort of thought to like, you know, what's going on in our culture, what's going on around us, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What are our surroundings? The surroundings were a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, they weren't playing Madison Square Garden.
Sure.
You know, they were playing The Kitchen on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a very, very different surrounding than what we have now. And that definitely was an ingredient to where music was going, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's also one thing too, where for it to spread like it did, it's someone heard it, then they applied it to what they're doing, then they applied it to what they're doing. It's not on MTV. It has to spread naturally over a relatively, you know, long course of time, couple years or so, but it doesn't, I don't know, you're not as inundated as with everything as you are today, where it's less impressive. You're kind of, we're washed over with everything through media. So it's more impactful when you hear it that way.
Oh, well, I mean, geez, man, I could sneeze right now and someone in Germany would hear it in like a half an hour on YouTube. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, you know, but, you know, then the way to pick up on this stuff was to go see people. You know what I mean? You'd have to actually go, or you'd be lucky enough to have a record cut, you know, at that point, you know?
Yeah, which that's not as easy as, I mean, you're so right there to get a record cut. It's expensive, or it's not the same as today, where we could record an album right now remotely using Zoom. It's a very different time. That's for sure.
Well, I didn't do enough, but I did a little research on record companies, and apparently Columbia was out in like the early to mid 30s or something like that. Like it went back pretty far.
Yeah,
but we're not talking about the massive conglomerates that we know today. You know, we're talking about literally like starting with like, I mean, you saw like Oh Brother Where Art Thou.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, where they're cutting it like in the studio or on wax, or, you know, they're singing into a can, you know, stuff like that, you know? So, to have those recordings at the time were sort of like a treasure, you know?
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until like the 50s that like, those record companies became very wealthy, and like Payola started, and you know, all that type of stuff started. You know?
An industry when there's money, when there's the opportunity to make a lot of money, that's when, the kind of seedy underbelly can, rear its head. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think too of like when some of these great recordings happened, there was one pressing of it at first. Yeah. And then that's the master that was played around. And it's just impressive that if you cut through at that point, you know, it's more, I don't say it's more impressive, but it was harder to get the publicity that was necessary to become a star, which a lot of people did, such as our next person here.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Elvis Presley, who we talked about a little bit before with Hound Dog, but now we're going to have a classic Elvis song. You want to set this one up at all, or you want to hear it first?
Yeah, let's play it first, because I want to talk about it right after.
Okay, so here's Jailhouse Rock, Elvis Presley, 1957.
One threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, and they began to wail. Jumping and the jump began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing. Let it rock, everybody, let it rock. Everybody in old cell block was dancing to the jailhouse rock.
So, in my thought, right off the bat, is there's more hi-hat than we've really heard so far. The snare is cracking, and it is it's a character in the song. It's an element of the song right off the bat. It is
right.
It's there. It's a great sounding snare.
Yeah. Amazing. And so I'm gonna have you play it again, but I'm gonna say something and then have you play it again. So if you listen to DJ Fontana's part, he's actually doing these ghost notes in the beginning, in between those hits. So it's like boom boom da 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 dun dun da da, and he's doing these extra ghost notes, right? And it's clearly swung. All right. And then when the guitar comes in, it's clearly straight.
Yeah.
So it's like this straight against swung thing. And I always draw this little thing on the whiteboard when I'm talking about history with my students, where I draw like sort of like steps where between this time and the end of the 50s into the 60s, there was this weird period of time where music is just sort of slowly gravitating from swung to straight.
Hmm.
And this to me is one of the first examples of where the crosshairs start to really fall on top of each other.
Yeah.
And again, it wasn't going from one day here, the next day there. It was this kind of like little weird, kind of crazy, mistaken, combination.
Yeah, kind of being pulled in both directions, and maybe they didn't really realize it at the time, but that's that's awesome. Let me play it again so we can hear that a little bit.
Yeah, listen to the ghost notes at first, and then when the guitar comes in, how it changes.
One threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing. Let it rock. Everybody, let it rock.
Yeah, da, 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 da. That's a good point. I mean, I never would have noticed that.
Yeah,
very, very kind of. I don't know. You feel a different with it. It's kind of polarizing. It that guitar sort of pulls you back. How would you? I wonder how it would have changed the song if the guitar was swung a little bit more, as opposed to the straightness. I kind of like the straight feel with that guitar.
I love it. And, you know, it's really emblematic of like what was going on in New Orleans even earlier in the 20s with what we call the crack, playing in the crack, where we're not really straight and we're not really swung. And this is another thing I draw on the board with my history descriptions. It's like if you draw a straight line, okay, and then you put like, a bar line at one end, a bar line another, and you put straight on one side and swung on the other. If you drew a line down the middle of the straight line, that would be somewhere in the middle, okay? But the crack is not necessarily in the middle. It could kind of waver, like, closer to swing or closer to straight. And if you listen to that song all the way through, it kind of, like, sort of changes. It's not really straight. It's not really swung. It almost sounds like, in a way, like, if I was going to drink and get real drunk, that's the way I would play, you know? It wouldn't be locked in. And that's really hard for me because as someone who's a session drummer, I feel like I got to really lock into something and play something straight through.
That's the double-edged sword of modern click track, pristine session drumming is you probably wouldn't get something like that, you know, whereas these guys back then were having, you know, either no click or some you're following someone's foot.
Right. So
it's
just,
it's got a feel, man. I mean, that's for sure. It's a very important piece of, it's like, it's just, it doesn't know what to do.
You know? Yeah. And it's not something that was explained at the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? These guys didn't get into the studio and go, well, you're going to play straight and you're going to play swung and we're going to be in the middle. Nobody knew what the hell they were doing.
That's a good point.
Or even talk about, you know, it just sort of evolved that way.
Yeah.
But that's the reason I think music did evolve to what it did. Through that sort of like, let's try things, let's experiment, let's do something new, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then by the time our next example came out, well, then at this point, it was completely straight. Well, not completely straight. Still, it was still like in that crack, but like definitely slid over to the straight dial more, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you a reason of what was going on with this. So this is Keep a Knockin' by Little Richard. And for anybody that knows about this, this is the famous introduction by Charles Connor on drums, who John Bonham took and played for Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin. But it started here, which is Keep a Knockin' by Little Richard.
Yeah, here we go.
Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. You said you love me and you can't come in. You said you love me and you can't come in. Woo!
Man, you hear that and you go, oh, that's where
that's
he got
where it's
it.
From.
It has this like, I just kind of like, it's like a wobbly kind of that, and you feel the same with Bonham, that da 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 da, like that hi-hat is so loose. I feel like
loose.
You're just not used to that either. You're used to a nice tight chick on the hi-hat. It's like pretty extreme.
Pretty heavy. So if anybody wants a good read, you should check out Charles Connor's book called Keep a Knockin', because he talks about his early days with Little Richard and how they all came about and how they were like touring monsters before this song came out and before Tutti Frutti came out and that sort of thing. But there's an amazing story to this song and how it came about. And it totally is indicative of the sound you'll hear. So Little Richard was writing this song. And I think it was like at night or something, like really late at night. He calls Charles Connor. He like goes to his store. And he's like, get in my car. And Charles is like, what are you doing? He's like, just get in my car. So they go for a ride. And he's racing next to a train. And he's like, open the door. Or he's like, open the window. So he opened the window. He's like, listen. And the train's going clack a clack 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 clack. And he's like, that's what I want.
Oh, wow.
That's what I want for the beginning of this song. So if you listen to the beginning of that song, it's like the way a train would be like slamming down the tracks at like 75 miles an hour.
Totally.
You know, that kind of thing.
That is so cool just to kind of know that. I mean, it's because once you hear that, you're not going to unhear that. You know, right. Now you're going to hear the train.
Right.
That's so neat, man.
Now, of course, those who don't know it, that is the beginning of Johnny Be Good. So it's the harmonic rhythm of Johnny Be Good mixed with the idea of trying to like get this sort of like, you know, ferocious train sound.
Yeah.
And but again, we're still not in that point. 'Cause this was 57 or 58 or something that.
Yeah, 50,
we're still not at that point of like the 60s and how music really straightened out, but it's in that steps thing I was telling you about. It's sort of like getting to the top of the stairs.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it's just the way the world has always worked out, but it's so neat, I think, how the decades really do define, usually like nice and cleanly, a difference in music where you think, oh, that's 90s rock, or that's 80s new wave music, or that's 70s kind of like, you know, disco or whatever. It is pretty amazing how things change. Like once we get up to 60, I mean, it's like, boom, we're now in another world of rock and roll. It's just neat how that kind of works out. You know what I mean? Like it typically does. The decade marker does constitute a change where each decade is almost working up to the next change to this day, obviously. It works out nicely like that.
So I always talk about that, and it's an amazing point. And I wonder, I always wonder if that is the way the music evolution just worked, or very specifically business decisions by record companies. Okay. Because if you start looking at the 60s, now you have, you know, the Beach Boys, which now is straightened out music, and it, it obviously changes into the surf thing, you know. And then, of course, the 60s are a little convoluted just because the middle of the 60s is really where the British invasion came about. But, you know, starting in like the 70s, you got the progressive rock thing in the early 70s. Then the late 70s, you have like the disco and the punk thing. Then the early 80s, you have the new wave. Then the late 80s, you have like the metal and the glam metal. And then the early 90s, you have grunge.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, I really think that like, you know, there was like sort of a 10-year business plan.
Sure.
You know,
totally.
From the labels. And they sort of would bookend those 10 years with something in the beginning and something in the end. And then they had to sort of reestablish it in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Because if you think about like right on the 80s and right on the 90s, right on 2000s, there was always like new things happening there. And it was like, what's going to catch on the most?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
To be the counterpoint, to be the opposite of, I mean, you think of the glam metal and then you think of like Nirvana. It's like
totally opposite.
Totally opposite. And it makes sense. I mean, you don't want to think that like, oh, we're being controlled that much. This is like kind of tinfoil hat conspiracy stuff. But it's like, you don't want to think we're being controlled that much. But really, it's like they know. I mean, it's human nature to get sick of big hair and, you know, makeup on, you know, glam rock guys. So boom, here's flannel and boots and kind of a downer music. It's almost like if this is popular, let's do the opposite. I mean, so how would you describe it then with, we got this kind of happy go lucky, Little Richard kind of like music into the 60s. What would be our next counter? Because this kind of music, it continued on, but what do you think in the 60s was the big, you know, in 1960, what would have hit that would have changed from this type of sound?
There was a very interesting time during the late 50s, and that is obviously the first thing that happened was the day the music died, the big plane crash with Ritchie Valens and Buddy Holly and Big Bopper. And that was a major thing because like a very big part of rock and roll literally died.
Sure.
The progression of rock and roll. Elvis went to the army. So for 2 years, he started literally cutting his music, like not doing anything in music for like 2 years. Okay. And if you read the Charles Connors book again, Little Richard, one of his plane rides, an engine went out and he thought that they were going to crash. So he ended up finding God and the Bible. And he went in this religious direction where he stopped playing music as well for a while.
Wow.
So there was this real weird chunk of the progression of rock and roll during that time that totally like sort of dropped out. So in the 60s, I don't know exactly why, but there was this sort of open door to let's do something totally new.
Sure.
And the Beach Boys came in and they were like the big thing at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, their music was more obviously about like same kind of thing. It was like the teen thing, but it was a different way. It was more like not just sort of like the sex part of it, but sort of the party and the beach and the waves,
surfing.
Yeah. And that kind of thing. And that whole like, you know, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that was also important too, because it was a big movement in instrumental rock at the time. With you know, that kind of thing. And that sort of was representative of like what the ocean was doing and the waves and that kind of thing.
The California craze.
California craze. And another thing that really opened the door for the British invasion was like up to that point, you think about, okay, who was the lead singer of Elvis Presley? Well, it was Elvis Presley. Who was the lead singer of Little Richard? Little Richard. Who was the superstar in Buddy Holly? Buddy Holly. Who is the lead singer of the Beach Boys?
Uh-oh. That's a good point.
Yeah. Now you have Mike Love and you have Al Jardine and you have
Brian Wilson.
Yeah. And you have like massive vocal harmonies.
Yeah.
And that was something that changed really big at the time. So now music has straightened out. Vocal harmonies are in. They're starting to waver a little bit from the blues progression. Of course, with Pet Sounds in the 60s, there's no blues anymore.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So it's like a big change at that time. But I don't, outside of like what happened at the end with the rock and roll thing, I'm not really sure if there was one specific reason, like a record company's like, I want to do something different. You know what I mean? It's hard to say.
Yeah, but those are great answers though, because there is usually, I mean, even like you said, the day the music died. I mean, there's just certain things that happen that it's all very, I don't know if serendipitous is the right word. It is kind of all, it just is, it's meant to be, it happens. And I hope that it's not all just the record companies controlling us behind the, but like culturally things change. Sure. It's awesome. And I think we're pretty close to the end here. I think it's neat to just look at that progression from the beginning to, you know, we were in the early 40s to 57 there, and recording quality got better, gear changed, the amount of focus on drumming and instruments changed, the style of singing changed. I feel like people got more confidence. It's, racially, I think things changed, sometimes for better or worse, but I think there was more stars of different, you know, not just white guys and girls, so... It's a really, really neat time that we've been able to look at. Now, as we're, you know, wrapping up here, Jason, why don't you kind of tell people what you got going on, what you're working on, where they can see you if they're in the New York area, New Jersey area, too. So, tell us about you a little bit and what you got going on.
Sure. Well, first of all, as everybody knows, the pandemic is still going on, and we're still dealing with, restrictions and who's touring and who's not. Before the pandemic, I was extremely busy on the road, but things have obviously changed, and I'm doing some fly dates again, but it's, you know, it's very sort of piecemeal-y at this point.
Sure.
So I do a lot of fly dates with the Rock of Ages Broadway band, along with John Weber, who's the principal player. So we're kind of different places here and there. I play pretty regularly with a violinist named Mark Wood, who is the original violinist of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra,
cool.
who I played with for 2 years. And I'm on the road with him quite a bit. But again, not as busy as it was before. And I sub on a couple of different Broadway shows, Rock of Ages, Little Shop of Horrors. Matter of fact, I just played a 4 or 5 show weekend with them, and I'm exhausted today. I'm like,
yeah.
I'm seeing little yellow dots in my music all over the place. And I teach at the Collective in New York City in New School. And I'm trying to think of other things, and right now I'm just spacing.
No, sure. I mean, if people want to take a lesson with you online, is that possible? Where can they find you?
Absolutely, yeah. Please contact me at my email, jason@drummersbible.com. That's my book. Many of you may have seen it, The Drummer's Bible. But yes, I am doing more and more online lessons these days. So please contact me at my email, and we'll get some online stuff going for sure.
Yeah, and I'll put that in the description as well, jason@drummersbible.com. And Jason has been kind enough to, after we finish this, he's going to hang out and we're going to record a little bonus episode, which just even for people listening, I usually try and do the bonus episodes. The last couple episodes in the month of December here in November, there's been some hour and a half, 2 hour long episodes. So at those points, sometimes I don't do the bonuses because I'm at the end, it's like, all right, we got to go. But today we are going to have a bonus episode, and we're going to talk about Jason's experience recording drums for the iconic SpongeBob SquarePants intro.
That's right.
I'm excited to hear this story. So if you want to sign up and hear this bonus episode and some others, go to drumhistorypodcast.com. There's a little Patreon link. I think it says become a patron on there. And for as little as $2 a month, you can get that. So Jason, well, thank you so much. I'm really glad we actually formally met and talked and set this up, because you are just a truly passionate guy and all about the drums, like all of us. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
It was such a pleasure, man. I love these podcasts, and I've seen your work before, and you're so good at what you do. And thank you so much for not only having me, but keeping the spirit of this alive, because, you know, with the technology, you know, drummers are starting to lose work. I've always been losing work for the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
And it's people like you and podcasts like this that keep it going. So thank you, man.
My pleasure. Thank you for the kind words. And thanks again for everyone for listening. And Jason and I are going to hop over and do the bonus. So thank you, Jason.
Awesome. See you guys soon.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.